pages of The Blue Wolves, but he seemed to struggle to understand the sentences and soon lost interest. The Blue Wolves landed with a thunk on top of The History of Syphilis.
"So what's this I hear about you killing the girl?" Chu asked.
Reseng's earlobes turned hot, and he didn't respond. Instead, he picked up the bottle and filled a glass a third of the way with Jack Daniels. Chu's eyes followed him closely. Reseng gazed at the glass for a moment before drinking. It tasted sweeter than the first glass.
"Where'd you hear that?" Reseng asked. His voice was calm.
"Here and there.
If you heard it while on the run, then I guess that means everyone knows.
Lots of crazy rumors in this business."
Chu raised an eyebrow, as if to ask why it mattered where he'd heard it. Reseng looked Chu straight in the eye. "Did Bear tell you?"
"Bear is a lot quieter than he looks."
Chu was taking care to defend Bear, which almost definitely meant that Bear was the one who'd told. There were plenty of places where word could have gotten out, but Bear had no reason to take risks for Reseng's sake. Around here, no one took foolish risks or went out of their way when it came to Chu, least of all Bear, with his two daughters, whom he struggled to raise on his own. Reseng understood. Had it been a detective sniffing around, Bear would have taken it to the grave. All the same, he couldn't help feeling annoyed. When word leaks out, it doesn't have to travel far before you end up in a plotter's crosshairs.
"Did you really think you could save her?" Reseng asked, not backing down.
"No, of course not. I'm not the type to save anyone. I'm too busy trying to keep myself alive."
"So there's nothing strange about what I did. You're the strange one."
"You're right. I'm the strange one. You did what was expected of you."
What was expected? Those words made Reseng feel both relieved and insulted. Chu moved over to the table and poured more alcohol. The bottle was already almost empty. Chu emptied his glass again, opened the second bottle, and poured himself another glass. He gulped that one down as well.
"I wanted to ask you something," Reseng said. "Did you ever go back to see her?"
"No."
"Then why let her live? Did you think the plotters would pat you on the shoulder and say, 'It happens to all of us'?"
"To be honest, I have no idea."
Chu drank another glass of whiskey. For someone who had gone without any alcohol for 2 years, he was having no trouble consuming an entire bottle all by himself in less than 20 minutes. His face was turning red. Did he really think he was safe in Reseng's apartment? Chu asked,
"Have you ever met any of the plotters who've given you orders?"
"Not once in 15 years.
"Don't you wonder?"
Chu asked.
"Who's telling you what to do, I mean? Who decides when you use the turn signal, when you step on the brake, when you step on the gas, when to turn left, when to turn right, when to shut up and when to speak?"
"Why are you wondering that all of a sudden?"
"I was standing there, looking at this girl who was just skin and bones, and I suddenly wondered who these plotters were anyway. I could have killed her with one finger. She was so scared. She just sat there, frozen. When I saw how hard she was shaking, I wanted to find out exactly who was sitting at their desk, twirling their pen, and coming up with this bullshit plan."
"I would never have guessed you were such a romantic."
"It's not about romance or curiosity or anything like that. I mean that I didn't realize until then just what a cowardly prick I'd been."
Chu sounded on edge.
"Plotters are just pawns like us," Reseng said. "A request comes in, and they draw up the plans. There's someone above them who tells them what to do, and above that person is another plotter telling them what to do. You know what's there if you keep going all the way to the top? Nothing, just an empty chair."
"There has to be someone in the chair."
"Nope, it's empty. To put it another way, it's only a chair. Anyone can sit in it. And that chair, which anyone can sit in, decides everything."
"I don't get it."
"It's a system. You think that if you go up there with a knife and stab the person at the very top, that'll fix everything. But no one's there. It's just an empty chair.
I've been in this business for 20 years. I've killed countless guys, including friends of mine. I even killed my protege. I gave him baby clothes at his daughter's first birthday party. But if what you say is true, then I've been taking orders from a chair all this time. And you broke a defenseless woman's neck because a chair told you to.
Chu downed another glass. As he caught his breath, he poured more whiskey for Rezing. Rezing ignored it and took a sip of his Heineken. He was tempted to blurt out that he hadn't broken her neck, but he swallowed the words back down with a mouthful of beer. Instead, Rezing said, "You can't shit in your pants just because the toilet is dirty." Chu sneered.
"You're sounding more and more like old raccoon every day," he said. "That's not good. Smooth talkers will stab a guy in the back every time."
"Whereas you sound more and more like a whiny brat. Do you really think this tantrum you're throwing makes you look cool? It doesn't. No matter what you do, you won't change a thing, just like you changed nothing for that girl." Chu unzipped the top of his jacket to reveal the leather gun holster under his arm that had been refashioned into a knife holster. He took out the knife and set it on the table. His movements were calm, not the slightest bit menacing.
"I could kill you very painfully with this knife. Make you shiver in agony for hours, blood gushing, steel scraping against bone, until your guts spill out of your body and hang down to the floor. Do you think you'll still be mouthing off about empty chairs and systems and claiming that nothing has changed? Of course not, because you're full of shit. Anyone who thinks he's safe is full of shit."
Rezing stared at the knife. It was an ordinary kitchen knife, a German brand, Henkel's. The blade was razor sharp, as if it had just come off the whetstone. The top of the handle was wound tightly with a handkerchief. Chu preferred that brand because it was sturdy. The blade didn't rust easily, and you could buy it anywhere. Other knife men looked down on the brand as a lady's knife that was good only for cooking at home. But in fact, it was a good knife. It didn't chip or break easily the way sushi knives did. Rezing peeled his eyes away from the knife and looked at Chu. Chu was angry, but his eyes lacked their usual venomous glint. The whiskey he'd guzzled must have gotten to him. Rezing thought about his own knife in the drawer. He tried to recall the last time he'd stabbed someone. Had it been 6 years? 7? He couldn't remember. Could he even get the knife out fast enough? If he made a move for it, Chu might grab his too. And if he did manage to get the knife out of the drawer in time, could he hold his own against Chu? Did he have any chance at all of being the victor? Unlikely. Rezing took out a cigarette and started smoking. Chu held out his hand. Rezing took out another cigarette, lit it, and passed it over to Chu, who inhaled deeply and leaned his head way back to stare at the ceiling. He held the pose for a long time, as if to say, "If you're gonna stab me, do it now." When the cigarette had burned halfway down, Chu straightened up and looked at Rezing.
"The whole thing's fucked up, isn't it? I've got all these goons coming after me, hoping to get a taste of that reward money. And meanwhile, I have no idea who to kill or what to do. To be honest, I don't even care if there is anything at the top. It could be an empty chair, like you say, or there could be some prick sitting in it. Won't make any difference either way to a knucklehead like me. I could die and come back in another form, and I still wouldn't understand how any of this works."
"Will you go to Hunja?"
"Maybe."
"Don't."
"Then where am I supposed to go instead?"
"Leave the country. Go to Mexico, the United States, France, maybe somewhere in Africa. Lots of places you could go. You can find work in a private military company. They'll protect you." Chu gave a furtive smile.
"You're giving me the same advice I gave that girl. Am I supposed to thank you now?"
Chu downed his whiskey, refilled it, downed it again, and emptied the rest of the second bottle into his glass.
"Aren't you going to drink with me? It's lonely drinking by myself."
Chu wasn't joking. He really did look lonely sitting there at the table, Rezeng drank the glass of whiskey Chu had poured for him. Chu opened the Johnny Walker Blue and poured Rezeng another shot. Then he raised his glass in a toast. Rezeng clinked his glass against Chu's. "Oh, that's much better," Rezeng said, sounding impressed. "I like this Johnny Walker Blue stuff better than that Real Man's or whatever Jack Daniels." Chu seemed genuinely amused. He didn't say much as they worked on the rest of the bottle. Rezeng didn't have anything to say either, so they drank in silence. Chu drank far more than Rezeng. When the bottle was empty, Chu stumbled into the bathroom. Rezeng heard the sound of pissing, then vomiting, then the toilet flushing several times. 20 minutes passed and still he did not come out of the bathroom. All Rezeng heard was the tap running. His eyes never left Chu's knife where it sat in the middle of the table. When Chu still hadn't come out after 30 minutes, Rezeng knocked on the door. It was locked, and there was no answer from inside. He got a flathead screwdriver to pry it open. Chu was asleep on the toilet, hunched over like an old bear, and the bathtub was overflowing onto the floor. Rezeng turned off the water and helped him to the bed. Once he was stretched out flat, Chu started to snore, as if he were getting the first good sleep of his life. His snoring was as loud as he was tall. It was so loud that even Lampshade timidly poked her head out from inside the cat tower, crept down to the bed, and started sniffing at Chu's face and hair. Rezeng sat on the couch and drank several more cans of beer, then fell asleep watching Desk and Lampshade enjoying their new game of swatting at Chu's hair and walking across his chest and stomach. When Rezeng awoke in the morning, Chu was gone. His big backpack was gone too. All that was left was his kitchen knife with the handkerchief wrapped around the handle, lying in the middle of the table like a present. A week later, Chu's body arrived at Bear's pet crematorium. By the time Old Raccoon and Rezeng got there, it was raining hard, just like on the day of Chu's visit. Bear held an umbrella over Old Raccoon as he got out of the car. "Is it done?" Old Raccoon asked. Bear looked surprised at the question.
"I haven't started yet."
Chu's body was in a tool shed. Bear had refrigerators for storing bodies, but they were small, meant for cats and dogs. He didn't have anything big enough to fit all 6'3" of Chu. Old Raccoon unzipped the body bag. Chu's eyes were closed.
"I counted 27 stab wounds," Bear said with a shiver.
Old Raccoon unbuttoned Chu's tattered shirt and counted the stab marks himself. Other than the one that had entered at the solar plexus and pierced a lung, most of the wounds hadn't proved fatal. The assassin could have killed him easily, but instead, he'd taken his sweet time, dancing around the vital spots, playing with Chu like a lion cub toying with an injured squirrel. Chu's right elbow was broken, the bone jutting through the skin, and his left hand was still locked tight around a knife. It was the same style and brand as the kitchen knife he had left on Rezeng's table. Rezeng tried to remove the knife from Chu's grip.
"I tried too," Bear said. "It won't come loose."
Old Raccoon gazed quietly at Chu's corpse for a moment before gesturing that he'd seen enough. His raised hand trembled. Bear hurriedly zipped the body bag shut.
"Hanja hired a real beast this time. He's called the Barber. Have you heard of him?" Bear asked. "Only rumors,"
Old Raccoon said gravely.
"They say he's a cleaner and that he's merciless. He specializes in taking out people like us. Pretty scary guy. What's the point of stabbing someone 27 times? Seeing the great Chu taken out this way, what chance do the rest of us have?"
Bear looked scared.
"We should be grateful to him for taking out garbage like us,"
Old Raccoon said in his usual cynical way. Bear loaded Chu's body onto a cart and trundled it over to the incinerator. Together, Rezeng and Bear lifted him onto the stainless steel tray. Chu's feet stuck out past the end.
Bear tried to bend his legs onto the tray, but rigor mortis had already set in.
Damn it, why has he got to make my life harder with these long legs of his?
Bear flopped down onto the ground and burst into tears. Resing gave him a pat on the shoulder and stepped outside. Old Raccoon stared wordlessly at Chu's body, his face expressionless. Finally, Bear got up. His eyes were bloodshot as he closed the door to the incinerator and turned on the power. Chu's body was nearly fully cremated by the time Hanja arrived. In addition to the driver, there was a slender man sitting in the black sedan with Hanja. Resing stared closely at him. He didn't look like he would be the one they called the barber. He was far too young to be the source of the terrible rumors associated with the name. Besides, the barber wouldn't have come all the way out here just for this. Hanja got out of the car and bowed politely to Old Raccoon, who responded with a barely perceptible nod. Even though it was 2 in the morning and a long way from anywhere, Hanja was clean-shaven and dressed in a suit and tie. After glancing around distractedly, he walked over to where Resing was squatting on the ground in front of the incinerator, smoking. The overpowering smell of Hanja's aftershave wafted ahead of him.
I'm late, but I didn't want to miss sending off a great warrior, Hanja said.
Resing looked up at him. Hanja gave him a wink to show he was joking.
I heard Chu stopped by your place before coming to see me.
That's so? Resing asked, his voice low.
I would think you'd have called me.
Resing took a long drag on his cigarette and didn't respond. Hanja took a silver pill case out of his pocket and popped a few mints in his mouth.
If you'd called me, you'd have gotten some of the reward money. Didn't I tell you I was giving half to whoever gave us information leading to his capture?
Hanja's voice had a teasing lilt.
I suddenly forgot your number, Resing said, stubbing his cigarette out on the ground.
Hanja took a business card out of his gold-plated case, leaned down, and slipped it into Resing's front pocket.
Make sure you call next time. We all have to work together.
With that, Hanja walked over to Bear, took a thick envelope out of his jacket pocket, and handed it to him. Bear bowed at a 90-degree angle as he took the envelope. With each word that Hanja said to him, Bear bowed again and said,
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Of course, sir.
His business with Bear concluded. Hanja lowered his head and looked into the incinerator for 3 seconds. Then he bowed politely once more to Old Raccoon, got in the car, and left. Resing lit another cigarette. We all have to work together. The words echoed in his head. Maybe Hanja was right. Guys like them had to work together. Because unlike them, real men guzzled Jack on an empty stomach, wailed like cats on the toilet, and died with their hands wrapped around a kitchen knife. The incinerator light turned off. Bear opened the door and waited for the heat to dissipate. Smoke billowed out, revealing the white bones of the old man and his dog. They looked as lonely and forsaken as a camel skeleton in the middle of the desert, eroded by sand and wind. Bear flicked away his cigarette and got to work. He spread a mat on the ground, placed a small table on top of it, and set the table with a candle, incense, a bottle of rice wine, and a wine cup. Bear checked to see if anything was missing, then looked over at Resing as if to ask why he wasn't joining him. Resing waved him off.
Go ahead and ask for forgiveness so you can go to paradise, Resing said.
I don't mind going to hell.
Bear lit the incense by himself and filled the cup with wine. He bowed twice, kowtowing before the hot white pile of bones resting inside the incinerator. He closed his eyes in contemplation for several long minutes while mumbling something under his breath. A prayer, perhaps, or an incantation. Then he stuck his finger in the wine cup and flicked the wine evenly into the air around the table and in front of the incinerator. Resing, who had no idea how Bear had come up with this ritual, sat off to one side and smoked until Bear had completed his ceremony and put away the mat. His insides burn from the cigarette smoke, making its way up and down his throat. Bear used a long metal hook to pull the tray out along the rails. Smoke was still rising from the bones. They looked too bare and insignificant to have belonged to the old man who had been laughing and chatting with the flowers and to the dog that had been running around in the garden only hours earlier. Bear pulled on a fresh pair of white gloves, picked up some tongs, and started carefully collecting the old man's bones.
"What should we do with the dog's bones?"
Bear asked. "Mix them together."
"What? We can't do that. Who mixes human and dog bones?"
Bear paused and stared at Resing.
"You did disobey orders, didn't you?"
Resing didn't respond.
"Why would you do that? You know what sticks in the mud those plotters are. They hate that sort of thing."
"Like anyone's going to pay that much attention to a bunch of ashes. They'll just end up scattered in a river without a trace."
"I better not be the only one who gets fucked over by this."
Rezeng shook his head, as if to dispel Bear's concerns. "Mixing the ashes will bring you luck. That dog was like a special gift to the old man. And you like things that bring you good luck." Bear thought it over for a moment, and then added Santa's bones to the box with the old man's.
"Back when this gentleman was a general," Bear murmured. "He used to drop by now and then, but never in uniform. He was so dapper."
He checked the tray carefully for any bone fragments he'd missed and swept the ashes together with a broom.
"When I die, I'm going to cremate my body right here," Bear said, mawkishly. "People like us should go the same way they do."
"That would be a good thing."
"Yes, a very good thing."
"But if you die, who'll do the cremating?" Bear looked stumped.
"Huh, I hadn't thought of that."
Bear put the bone fragments into an iron mortar and began grinding them by hand. He ground them down very fine, careful not to let any of the bone dust fly out. Beads of sweat sprang up on his forehead. Even after the bones looked fully pulverized, he ran his fingers through the ash and resumed grinding whenever he felt even the slightest shard. Finally, after nearly 20 minutes, Bear set down the pestle. He carefully transferred the pulverized bone to a maplewood box, wrapped it in a cloth, and handed it to Resing. The ashes were still hot. Rezeng put the wooden urn on the passenger seat of his car, took an envelope from his pocket, and gave it to Bear, who took out the bills and counted them twice.
"Would you like a receipt for your taxes?"
Bear said, with a grin. "As if I file taxes."
"Drop by more often. That's the only way we'll both make ends meet. I've been dying lately,"
Bear said, with a pout. Rezeng smiled, weakly. Resing got in the car and started the engine. The sun was peeking over the ridge. As the sunlight touched his face, the tension left his body, and he felt dizzy. He put his hand on his forehead and rested his head against the window. When the car still hadn't moved, Bear came over and tapped on the glass.
"You okay?"
Startled, Resing looked up at Bear through sunken eyes.
"If you're tired, take a nap before you leave."
Bear looked worried. Rezeng shook his head. "I have to get going." He gave Bear a nod to show he was okay, then released the brake and put the car in gear. He made his way down the mountain toward the highway that would take him back to Seoul. The reflection of Bear waving in the rearview mirror grew smaller and smaller until it was gone.
The Doghouse Library. Of course, there weren't any actual dogs there. Old Raccoon was hardly the type to raise dogs in a library. He'd named his library the Doghouse to make fun of people who made a big show of frequenting libraries but never opened any actual books, or possibly to make fun of himself for having spent a good 60 years of his life looking after a library that sat empty of people most of the time. He'd even hung a large signboard engraved with the name The Doghouse, right above the entrance. People visiting the place for the first time usually stared up at it, dumbfounded, their heads tilted at a quizzical angle, or laughed. Then, After a second, their faces would turn sour. Wait, is he calling us dogs? What the fuck? What was he thinking when he hung that sign? Rezing attributed it to the cynicism typical of traditional, uptight intellectuals who spent their lives confined to private rooms, the walls padded with books. Unless it was Old Raccoon's way of thumbing his nose at the world that had taken a young librarian leading a simple, happy life with his books, albeit saddled with a limp from a childhood bout with polio, and made him work for years and years as a middleman for plotters and assassins. Whatever the reason, the sign brought him no end of amusement. Rezing thought it was childish. If this were his library, there was no way he would have hung that sign. But life never goes the way we want it to, and so, if he had found himself forced to hang that sign, through some odd combination of complicated and underhanded stipulations and well-timed blackmail, as if anyone would blackmail someone into doing something so random, then at least he would, of course, have brought in a few actual dogs, along with books from all over the world about dogs. He pictured a young scholar raising his eyebrows at him and asking, "But Mr. Rezing, what kind of name is that for a library? The Doghouse? Are you trying to insult humanity's noble world of the mind?" Rezing would give the young scholar a polite, dignified smile and say, "Why, of course not, young man. I haven't the slightest intention of flipping the bird at humanity's noble world of the mind. What on earth makes you think that? Perhaps we need to start with your prejudiced notion that books and dogs don't belong together." He would point to the dogs strolling casually among the crowded shelves. "Look at these dogs. Aren't they magnificent? And right over here, from D11 to D43, are all sorts of books on the subject of dogs. This library has the world's largest collection of books on dogs. We've got books on Chihuahuas, Collies, Shepherds, Greyhounds, St. Bernards, Retrievers. We have books on every single breed of dog in the world. And not only that, this library also has books on dog food, dog breeding, dog lineage, canine interspecies conflict, and a lot more. You might even say this library is the spiritual heart of dogdom, the canine Vatican, if you will." At last, the young scholar would nod. "I see, yes, I understand now. Your work is quite impressive." "It's a sacred task. The canine Vatican. Wouldn't that be something?" The more he thought about it, the more it seemed like both the dogs and the books would appreciate it and feel elevated by it. But Old Raccoon had not intended any such elegant metaphor. Instead, his choice of the word doghouse hinted at the fact that the library, established in the 1920s, right after Imperial Japan had renamed its colonizing strategy from martial rule to cultural rule, had survived for decades in the shadow of authoritarianism, that it had a shameful and obscene history of its own as the headquarters of every major assassination in South Korea's modern history, and that he was disgusted with himself for being a part of that shameful history. But Old Raccoon chose that life. Why pick on poor innocent dogs for choices he'd made? Seriously, what did dogs ever do wrong? 10 a.m., Rezing entered the doghouse library. It was empty, as usual. The sole employee, a cross-eyed librarian, greeted Rezing, her gaze pointing at some spot he could only guess at.
"Good morning!"
Her cheery voice echoed like a lark's cry from the domed ceiling. That high-pitched voice vexed him every time. It sounded far too bright for a place built during the colonial era by a Japanese master craftsman, and left to rot over the next century. He gave the librarian a curt nod and headed straight for Old Raccoon's study.
"He has a visitor," she said,
rising from her seat. Rezing paused. Who would come to the library this early with a job for them? "A visitor?" Rezing asked. "Who is it?"
"That tall, smart-looking gentleman. The really polite one."
Tall, smart, and polite. Someone with those qualities would have no reason to be skulking around here. Rezing tipped his head in confusion. Her voice turning impatient, the librarian added,
You know, the guy who wears nice suits and sounds really cool and dignified all the time.
Reseng snorted. She meant Hanja. The cross-eyed librarian thought Hanja was polite and smart and cool and dignified. And all the time, apparently. What on earth had given her that idea? On the other hand, maybe Reseng was the one who had the wrong idea. After all, Hanja was rich, had a fancy degree from Stanford, and was constantly acting the part of a gentleman. Though Reseng could not get on board with the idea that the guy was handsome, he couldn't argue with the fact that Hanja was tall. Reseng nodded and headed again for Old Raccoon's study, but the librarian rushed over and pulled at his arm.
He told me not to let anyone else in, not today.
She stressed the words, not today, as if this day was some once-in-a-lifetime event. She had a tight grip on his arm. He looked pointedly at her hand, and then slowly up at her face. She let go. Which one of them told you not to let anyone in? Old Raccoon or Hanja? She hesitated.
Hanja, but Mr. Raccoon was standing right next to him when he said it.
Reseng looked at the closed door. Given how early Hanja had rushed over, he must have been pretty angry about how the plot got twisted. Reseng put the maple box containing the ashes of the old man and the dog on the round table in front of the librarian's desk. He sat down and took a pack of cigarettes from his pocket. The second he lit up, the librarian frowned at him. She sat down at her desk and began to knit. He assumed this meant she'd already completed her tasks for the day. The yarn was red. She hadn't gotten far enough with it yet for him to tell what she was knitting. Reseng had never once seen her read a book. She never even read newspapers or magazines. She just sat by herself at her desk in that deserted library where no books were ever read or checked out and, naturally, were never returned, and passed the time knitting or cross-stitching or painting her nails every color of the rainbow.
What is that?
Asked the librarian, pausing abruptly in the middle of a row.
Japanese sweets?
She was looking at the box he'd placed on the table. The maple box was wrapped in a white cloth and looked unmistakably like a wooden urn. Reseng had no idea what made her think it was sweets. Yeah, they're Japanese sweets, but they're not for you, so keep your paws off them. She stuck her lower lip out at him. It was covered in a thick coat of bright red lipstick. Right above her mouth was a beauty spot that seemed disappointed not to have been born on Marilyn Monroe's face. She'd applied dark red shadow all around her eyes, and her eyebrows were shaved and replaced by two crescent tattoos. The overall effect made her look odd and simple-minded. That said, other than being cross-eyed, she wasn't bad-looking. She resumed knitting and seemed to forget all about Reseng sitting in front of her. Her knitting was faster now, but there was still something sloppy and uncertain about her work. She probably had trouble focusing on the stitches. You should get surgery, Reseng said. She looked up at him in confusion. I said, you should get surgery.
What surgery?
For your eyes, to uncross them. They say it's a simple procedure nowadays, doesn't even cost that much. She looked taken aback. Her expression seemed to say, don't you have enough problems, you idiot? Stay out of my business. Or possibly, it was saying, I don't care if my eyes are flipping inside out. Why should I care what a loser like you thinks?
It's no one's business what I'm looking at, she said curtly.
She gave him a long, lingering glare. This time, her expression clearly said, be warned, your insolence will not be tolerated. You've made me very angry. But with one eye pointing at the ceiling and the other eye pointing at the stacks to the left, that warning came off as more comical than stern. Not that Reseng didn't take her seriously. It's just that it's next to impossible to make a serious threat when you're staring simultaneously at the floor and at the ceiling. I'm sorry, he said. I didn't mean it the way it sounds. She didn't respond. Instead, she muttered something indecipherable and kept on knitting. Her irritation spelled out all over her face. He assumed she'd told him to fuck off under her breath. Old Raccoon had gone through a lot of librarians. Most of his reasons for firing them were pretty frivolous. He had fired librarians because a book was misshelved, because a 2-decades-old book had a tiny tear on the cover and had been left unrepaired for over a month, and because there was too much dust on one of the over 900 shelves. He'd even fired one librarian for setting a coffee cup on top of a book. Of course, there were plenty who'd left of their own accord. One left because she said there wasn't enough work to do. Another said the place was so dreary that she felt as if she was suffocating. Still another said being alone in the constantly empty library made her feel like a character in a horror movie. And one librarian's mysterious reason for leaving was that ever since setting foot in the place, she hadn't been able to read so much as a single sentence. Reseng had gotten along well with most of the librarians, regardless of how long they lasted. He considered them friends, his only friends, in fact, with whom he could talk about books. With them, he was able to share the thoughts and emotions the books had aroused in him, which may have been why talking to librarians always left him feeling a certain sense of kinship and peace of mind. It usually didn't take long for the librarians to wonder about the peculiarities of the library. They would steal a moment when Old Raccoon wasn't around to ask Reseng cautiously what the purpose of the library was and what institution it belonged to. Anyone who found themselves working in that odd place with its crabby owner for longer than a month would naturally start to wonder. Each time he was asked, Reseng explained that it was a members-only library for high-ranking government officials. They would tilt their heads and say, "But I've never once seen a government official come in to read or check out a book." And Reseng would say, "That's why our country is so messed up," and laugh. But the cross-eyed librarian had never, not even once, asked any questions about the place. When she first started the job, she didn't ask where her desk was or what her tasks were. Worse still, or according to the same logic, she didn't ask where the bathroom was or where the broom was stored. It was as if she had no curiosity, interest, or complaints about anything apart from cross-stitching, nail art, and knitting. When Old Raccoon gave her instructions, she listened, with those unsettling eyes of hers aimed any which way, and silently got to work. So far, she'd lasted a good 5 years at the doghouse library without asking a single question. She had probably been there the longest of all the librarians who'd worked for grumpy, fickle Old Raccoon. She paid no mind whatsoever to what sort of place this library was that stayed empty all year round, or who these people were who came in from time to time with mean, secretive looks on their faces. She just reported for work in the morning and wiped dust off the books. The rest of the time, she feverishly knit or cross-stitched. But most surprising of all was her unfailing ability to shelve the books so accurately that not even Old Raccoon, who was more exacting than anyone, could find fault with her. Reseng was forever surprised and dubious at how perfectly a librarian who never read could keep books so well organized. She was, by far, the strangest librarian he'd ever met. Now and then, Reseng would mention a book he was reading, and she would instantly reply in a monotone, chin resting on her hand,
"C-54 has other books like that. Go and have a look."
What else could he do, of course, but head straight for C-54, feeling vaguely disconcerted and let down? Until recently, the library's collection had held steady at 200,000 books. Old Raccoon used to order new books regularly, but he would throw out the same number just as regularly. He claimed he did that because there was no room, but they could have easily stored hundreds of thousands more. The real reason he threw them out was because more books would have meant adding more shelves, and Old Raccoon was loath to move the existing shelves, which he had long ago arranged just so. As far as Reseng could remember, the shelf layout in the doghouse library had never once changed. Neither had Old Raccoon's method for sorting the books. Nor did he make room for new categories of books that appeared with the changing times. As a result, books that could not be sorted into one of Old Raccoon's existing categories went straight into the discard pile, even if they were brand new. When their time came, Old Raccoon placed a black strip of paper around the discards. It was his own special form of sentencing, a funeral procedure for books that had reached the end of their life. the same way aging assassins were added to a list and eliminated by cleaners when their time came. Of course, a book's lifespan was determined by Old Raccoon alone, and neither Reseng nor the librarians could understand why certain books had to be tossed. The books with black bands were gathered by the librarian and stacked in the courtyard to be burned on Sunday afternoons, the librarian's day off. Old Raccoon could have sold them to a second-hand bookshop or even to a recycler, but he insisted on burning them. Reseng was fond of Old Raccoon's abandoned books. Though he couldn't quite explain why, he felt they deserved his love. And they were the only books he was allowed to take home from the doghouse. On Sunday mornings, before the books were burned, Reseng would peruse the pile next to the gasoline can and pick out those he liked. After he had finished, the remaining books were left scattered around in the yard, unwanted by either Old Raccoon or Reseng, and looking as pathetic and hopeless as prisoners of war standing before a firing squad. "You don't have to burn them," Reseng would say. "You could sell them to a second-hand bookshop instead." Each time, Old Raccoon responded in the same way.
"Every book must follow its own destiny."
In other words, the particular destiny of the books that had belonged to this ridiculous, godforsaken place where no one came to read, not even the librarian, was to be as bored and miserable as court ladies, their untouched virgin bodies wasting away as they pined in sorrow, never once to be loved by the king, until they eventually grew too old and were cast out of the palace. Reseng was confident in his knowledge that the library would be around for at least as long as people were. He had faith not in the books, but in the shelves and in the edifice itself that held them. What had sustained the doghouse all this time were its large wooden bookshelves, carved from the same priceless Chunyang pines used to build palaces during the Joseon dynasty. Books came and went, but those heavy shelves, lovingly crafted by a famous furniture maker during the colonial era and still pristine and unwarped 90 years later, never so much as budged. The cross-eyed librarian had been knitting for 30 minutes straight. Each time Reseng lit another cigarette, she raised her head and fixed him with a frown. But he kept right on smoking, unfazed. He had no hope of getting anywhere with her anyway. In her mind, Hanja was distinguished and cool, and Reseng was a dud. "What time did Hanja get here?" he asked. Without looking up, she said,
9:30.
"When did you get here?"
8.
That was early. The library didn't open till 9, so why had she come an hour early? There was nothing for her to do except clean. He really couldn't understand her. Reseng looked at the door to Old Raccoon's study again. It was still shut. If Hanja had come at 9:30, that meant he and Old Raccoon had been talking for over an hour. What on earth about? Whenever Hanja met with high-ranking government officials or other powers behind the throne, he told them Old Raccoon was like a father to him. Sometimes he dropped the word like and simply called him his father. The doghouse library's gruesome 90-year history lent Hanja, who was a relative newbie to the assassination business, an air of tradition and authority. Prone to paranoia and easily spooked, the geezers who pulled the strings still trusted Old Raccoon's neat and tidy approach to getting the job done. Now and then, while hearing yet another rumor about Hanja's name-dropping and his riding on Old Raccoon's coattails, Reseng thought maybe he really was his son. After all, a monster like Hanja could only have been sired by another monster. Reseng was lighting yet another cigarette when he heard shouts coming from Old Raccoon's study. He and the librarian looked up at the same time. More shouts. Old Raccoon's voice. The librarian looked at Reseng in bewilderment. Just then, Hanja came storming out. His face was flushed. He hadn't shaved. Even his hair looked uncombed. It was clear he'd rushed directly to the library the second he heard that the plot to kill the old man had been changed. It was the first time Reseng had seen Hanja lose his composure. In fact, it was also the first time he'd heard Old Raccoon yell like a drunken sailor. Old Raccoon's special skill was sarcasm, not volume. As Hanja stomped past, he spotted Ressing and stopped short. His eyes shot back and forth in shock from Ressing's face to the wooden urn wrapped in the white cloth. "What is that?" Hanja asked, angrily. "Japanese sweets." Hanja glared at Ressing, biting down hard on his lip, as if he wanted to punch him. But he regained his cool and sneered instead. He started to say something, but then turned to the cross-eyed librarian. "I'm sorry, miss, but would you mind excusing us? I need to have a word with this gentleman." She looked up at him blankly. He tipped his head ever so slightly to one side. All at once, she leaped up and switched back to the high-pitched, bird-like voice she used whenever she was being polite.
"Why, yes, of course, not a problem."
She dropped her knitting needles on the desk. But now that she was out of her chair, she got flustered, obviously unsure about where she was supposed to go, and turned to Hanja again with an awkward smile before rushing outside. After they heard the door click shut behind her, Hanja pulled out a chair and sat across from Ressing. "Mind giving me one of those?" He gestured to the pack of cigarettes on the table. "I thought you hated things that stink." Hanja frowned. He was clearly in no mood for messing around, and he looked haggard, as if he hadn't slept at all. Ressing pushed the cigarette pack and lighter toward him. Hanja tapped one out, lit it, and took a deep drag before exhaling a long plume of smoke into the air. "It's been so long, it's making me dizzy." He rubbed his eyes, as if he really was dizzy, or else the smoke was irritating them. They looked bloodshot. Hanja started to take another drag, but he changed his mind and stubbed out the cigarette in the ashtray. He stared for a long time at the wooden urn. "I specifically asked for the general's body, and you bring me a box of ashes. I can't use ashes." Hanja spoke in a near whisper. Ressing didn't respond. "How did such a simple task get so messed up?" Hanja's voice was soft, placating. Ressing guessed he was sounding him out in order to understand why Old Raccoon had changed the plotter's orders. "Look," Ressing said. He wanted to show him there was no point in prodding him on this, that nothing would come of it. "I'm just a hitman who works for a daily wage. Minions like me follow the orders we're given, so obviously I have no idea what's going on." "No idea." Hanja tapped his fingers lightly on the table. Ressing reached over to retrieve his lighter and cigarettes and lit another. "How many do you smoke a day?" Hanja asked. 2 packs. "Do you not watch the news? Lung cancer is the most lethal form of cancer, and if you smoke, you're 15 times more likely to get it. For a heavy smoker like you, lung cancer is a given." "I doubt I'll survive in this business long enough to get lung cancer." Hanja snorted. "You're a funny guy. I've always thought that about you," Hanja said. "You're tough to read, but you amuse me. I guess that's why I like you." Ressing crushed his unfinished cigarette out in the ashtray and lit up another. As Hanja kept on jabbering, "Yeah, a real peach you are." Ressing fought the overwhelming urge to punch him right in the mouth. "That job was worth billions," Hanja said. "That plot was going to be huge, the likes of which a mere day laborer like you could never imagine. But then Old Raccoon blew it before it even began."
"Gee, what a shame. All that money gone. My heart bleeds for you."
"I'm sure I can salvage it. That's my specialty, after all. But who's going to compensate me for the blow this has struck to my honor and credibility? That nasty Old Raccoon? Or some lonely goon like you?"
Ressing felt disgusted to hear the words honor and credibility coming out of Hanja's mouth. "Since when is your stupid honor more important than the general's?"
"What does a corpse need honor for? Leave him be and he'll rot in the ground like he's supposed to."
"I'll be sure to ask your corpse the same question on the day Bear cremates you. I'll ask right before you're shoved into the oven."
"See to it that you do. I can assure you that my corpse will give you the same answer I'm giving you now. We're businessmen. Who would do something this stupid when there are billions of won at stake? If you just turned over the body like you were told, I could have packaged it into something worth selling by now. The politicians and the press can do whatever they want with it after that. I don't care."
"He was Old Raccoon's only friend,"
Rezing shouted. Not that a loser prick like you would understand that. Hanja let out an arrogant laugh. He seemed to relish the fact that Rezing had slipped and revealed his true feelings, as if that had been Hanja's intention all along, and now he'd gotten what he wanted from him.
See, I told you, you're a funny guy, Hanja said.
Hanja had been planning to get the story out on the 9 o'clock news. He wanted the assassination to be front page, above the crease, in every single newspaper around the country. The death of a general, originally from North Korea, and a key figure back in the days of the KCIA, before it evolved into the National Intelligence Service. And embedded in his corpse, an unfamiliar 7.62mm slug that could only have come from a Russian-made AK-47. A suspicious assassination by firearm, positively reeking of foul play. The day after the body was discovered, yellow police tape would have gone up all around the old man's house, and the normally deserted forest would have been suddenly buzzing with journalists and TV reporters blowing every little thing out of proportion, and bumbling cops who had no idea what they were supposed to be doing. The TV news would have demonstrated how thoroughly scientific the search for clues was by filming the forensics team walking abreast as they noisily sifted through the forest at 1 centimeter intervals, starting at the point of impact. The screen would have filled with the giant face of a balding expert, looking extremely serious as he prepared to give an interview. While pointing out exhibits 1, 2, 3, and 4, a shell casing, a chewing gum wrapper, an empty cookie packet, human feces, found by the forensics team, the giant-faced expert would have spouted endless nonsense about the changing state of international affairs and the movements of the North Korean military. The next day, and the day after that as well, the news would have been full of commentary on the chewing gum wrapper, the empty cookie packet, the human feces. What was it that they were hoping to start? In this day and age, when you can book a seat on a small space shuttle, rocket up out of the atmosphere, and stare slack-jawed down at the Earth for 5 long, space tourist minutes before descending, were they seriously thinking of trying to turn this into another worn-out, spiring cliché? Not that anyone could have said where the plot originated or what its ultimate goal was. No one ever knew the full truth. In the plotter's world, everyone avoided having any more information than absolutely necessary. The more information you had, the easier it was to become a target. Ignorance was survival. You couldn't just pretend. You had to genuinely not know. Why would anyone bother asking how much you knew when they could simply kill you? That's why everyone stayed inside their own small fence and didn't stick so much as a single toe out of it. Put enough of those small fences together, and you got a plot, woven together from ridiculously large and intricate connections and countless stakeholders. Perhaps they'd been planning to blow up a dam, and for budget reasons had forced a turnabout by assassinating a washed-up former general instead. At any rate, the plot had gone awry. The corpse they were planning to use had been reduced to ash. Just as Hanja has suggested, you can't squeeze a media circus out of a pile of dust. Hanja checked his watch and stood up. He'd said all he had to say. Time to go. Everything's fucked because of you, and I'm the one stuck with the bill. Because of me? Rezing asked, wide-eyed. If you knew that old raccoon had changed the plot, then you should have warned me. Hanja's voice dripped with pity. You didn't belong on this job in the first place. I don't know why you would butt in and risk taking the fall for him. Hanja was much calmer and more relaxed now than when he'd burst out of old raccoon's study. A consummate realist, he knew how to brush off mistakes. He might even have already thought of his next big stunt. And just in case that gave you the wrong idea about yourself, Hanja added, let me give you some advice. Don't overestimate yourself. You're nothing. That spot you're standing on is all you've got. The second you step outside this library, you're just another washed-up assassin from the meat market. Just another disposable needle, used once and thrown away. So watch yourself. And go easy on the cigarettes. If you keep ruining your lungs with those 2 packs a day of yours, how are you going to be able to run for your life when the time comes? Hanja gave him another of his arrogant, hateful smiles. He straightened his jacket as he prepared to leave. Oh, have I given you my card? He asked, his gestures exaggerated, as if he'd overlooked some critical detail. Rissing stared at him and did not answer. Hanja took a card from his gold-plated case and set it in front of Rissing.
You'll need this. The library won't be open much longer. And you should start thinking about your future. Maybe learn to speak more politely. Speaking Banmal to your elders doesn't look good. I'm telling you this for your sake, he said, with a wink.
I talk down to anyone and everyone, and you are just anyone to me. Rezeng stuck Hanja's business card in the ashtray and stubbed his cigarette out on it. Hanja watched him for a moment and shook his head, then took out another card and this time shoved it into Rezeng's jacket pocket. He patted Rezeng on the cheek.
Grow up. How much longer do you think you'll get away with acting cute?
Hanja strode out of the library, whistling as he went. As the door swung shut, Rissing heard Hanja cheerfully say to the librarian,
Wow, pretty chilly out here. So sorry to make you wait. The conversation just dragged on and on.
He heard her response.
Oh no, it's not that cold.
She sounded giddy. Rissing took out another cigarette, but he stared at it without lighting up. Hanja was right about one thing. Rissing should never have been assigned to take out the general. Plotters didn't use highly skilled assassins like him when the goal was only to stir up the news. That type of job belonged to washed-up hitmen whom no one ever hired anymore, or disposables fresh out of army training, still wet behind the ears and with no clue about how things worked. Whenever an assassination came to light, the first person the police looked for was the shooter. In the end, all they wanted to know was, who pulled the trigger? When they did find whoever had pulled the trigger, they fooled themselves into thinking that everything had been solved. But when you think about it, the question of who pulled the trigger doesn't matter at all. In fact, it might even be the least important question in an assassination case. What matters is never the shooter, but the person behind the shooter. And yet, in the long history of assassinations, not once has that shadow person been clearly revealed. People believed Oswald killed Kennedy, but how could a bumbling idiot like Oswald have pulled it off? While the press and the police were busy fingering Oswald, the plotters of assassinations and the pullers of strings who'd orchestrated Kennedy's death slowly and leisurely scattered in different directions and headed back to their nice, safe homes. There, they leaned back in their easy chairs, sipped their champagne, and watched the news. A few days later, when Oswald the Clown was eliminated on schedule by another third-rate assassin, the police closed the case, the looks on their faces saying, well, what can we do now that the key culprit is dead? Life is one big comedy. All the police have to do is find the shooter, and all the plotters have to do is eliminate him. The police track down a shooter, interrogate him, torture him. This simpleton who pulled a trigger without thinking becomes the media's next hot topic faster than his bullet found its target. Everyone who knows him expresses surprise and alarm to learn he was capable of something so awful. The media digs up everything they can about him, tracks down anyone and everyone who might be even remotely related to him, though in truth they are unconnected, pixelate their faces for privacy, and turn the simpleton into a legend. The funniest part is that the idiot who actually pulled the trigger knows next to nothing about what happened. He himself has no idea what he has done. Why on earth would plotters give such important information to a has-been or a disposable? The plotter's instructions to the assassin are always the same, regardless of country or era. Who told you to think? Just shut up and pull the trigger. Rezeng lit the cigarette. It occurred to him that if he hadn't cremated the old man, he'd be a corpse too, right about now. What would Bear's face look like while feeding Rezeng's body into the flames? Would that big teddy bear of a man weep hysterically, only to chuckle and bow over and over when Hanja handed him his cash, his tears having mysteriously vanished as he counted the bills twice? Rezeng was on his second inhale when the cross-eyed librarian came back in, shivering from the cold. She wrapped the cardigan that she'd left on her chair around her shoulders and crouched under her desk, rubbing her hands over the space heater she'd kept there. She was down there for a long time before she finally came back up and sat in her chair.
"For fuck's sake, knock it off with the damn smoking already," she exclaimed,
her face livid with contempt. Ressing stubbed out his cigarette. He looked over at Old Raccoon's study. The door was still closed. Should he go in now, or should he wait until Old Raccoon had calmed down? He couldn't decide. "What are you going to do if this place closes?" he asked the librarian.
"The library is closing."
She looked shocked. "No," I said, "what if it closes?" She hesitated and said,
"I'll find a nice guy and get married."
"A nice guy, huh?" Reseng chewed over her words and asked, "How about me?" She looked at him as if he were crazy.
"What's wrong with you? Someone shoot you in the head while I was gone."
Her voice was so loud that it echoed off the domed ceiling. Reseng laughed. He picked up the urn and walked over to Old Raccoon's study. When he opened the door, Old Raccoon was reading an encyclopedia out loud, as always. He'd finished the Brockhaus Encyclopedie and was rereading the Encyclopedia Britannica. To Ressing's surprise, he looked completely unruffled. He was sitting in the same chair he always sat in, with the same book, reading out loud in the same voice. What was the purpose of reading the same two books over and over? His reading habits made no sense to Ressing. Old Raccoon kept reading until Ressing had shut the study door and set the urn on the coffee table. Though he didn't do it on purpose, the urn clacked loudly against the glass top. At last, Old Raccoon looked up from his book and stared at the urn.
"Why were you gone an extra day?"
He didn't sound angry or accusatory, merely curious. "The general invited me to stay for dinner." He thought that would invite follow-up questions, but Old Raccoon nodded. He set his reading glasses on the desk, got up, and came over to the table, then unwrapped the white cloth from the urn and examined the box, briefly caressing the wood with his palm before opening the lid. The old man's and Santa's ashes were neatly wrapped in white paper. Old Raccoon unfolded the paper and ran the ash through his fingers. He could probably tell at once that there were more ashes in the box than there should have been, and that some of it had a different consistency than human cremains. But his face revealed nothing. For all Ressing knew, Cowardly Bear might have already called Old Raccoon to confess about the dog, just to cover his own ass.
"Bear ground them really fine."
Old Raccoon sounded pleased. That was his only reaction. He folded the paper back, closed the lid, and retied the white cloth. Then he put the urn on his desk.
"Lie low for a few days," he said. "Don't do anything."
That meant Ressing was excused. Hunter looked pretty angry. Old Raccoon let out a short laugh.
"What's he got to be angry about? He got what he wanted."
But he was carrying on about us blowing a plot worth billions of won.
"You really think he'd trust us with something that big? He's thrilled because now he has a reason to run around telling those old government geezers that the doghouse messed up. Ha! I swear he's too clever."
Old Raccoon seemed amused, but what on earth was there to laugh about? "Is the library closing?" Ressing asked. Old Raccoon looked confused. "Hunja tried to scare me by saying the library is closing." Old Raccoon thought about it for a moment. A strange smile came over his face.
"If it closes, it closes," he said flatly. "What's there to be afraid of? Not like there was ever any glory in the library anyway."
But how could that be? How could he close the library that he'd personally overseen for the last 60 years? Old Raccoon's voice was calm and blunt, as if he'd been readying himself for this moment for a long, long time. Perhaps that was why he sounded so determined as well. Everyone said that Old Raccoon was born in the library and had lived there his whole life. It wasn't a metaphor. He actually was born in it. He was the son of the handyman who'd lived in a cottage attached to the library and had kept the roof, electricity, and plumbing in working order. After the bout of polio that left him with a permanent limp, Old Raccoon went to work keeping the library clean when he was only 6 years old. At the age of 15, he became a librarian, and at the tender age of 21, he became head librarian. It wasn't clear how Old Raccoon, who was not only disabled but hadn't even finished elementary school, was able to beat out the colonial officials who'd graduated from Keijo Imperial University in Seoul or studied abroad in Japan to become first head librarian and then later director of the library. Perhaps the library was far too quiet and boring a place for smart people to devote their whole lives to. Or perhaps it was just too dangerous. Old Raccoon was studying the urn closely. After a moment, he seemed to realize Rasing was looking at him and turned his gaze back to the encyclopedia. But it was obvious he wasn't actually reading. He'd forgotten to put his reading glasses back on. As Old Raccoon stared blindly at the page, he suddenly looked much older. "I'll get going," Rasing said. Old Raccoon glanced up and nodded. When Rasing came out of the study, the cross-eyed librarian was gone. He assumed she'd left to eat lunch. He sat down in her chair. To one side of the desk were her knitting needles and a skein of red yarn. A partition concealed a collection of 10 or so bottles of nail polish organized by color, a dainty mini vanity, and a makeup bag that looked like the sort of thing professional makeup artists would take with them to a movie set. Next to it was a set of plastic drawers